comics,
movies,
music,
video games,
technology,
Blu-ray,
television.
This is the HHW LOD Podcast Network.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com.
Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast.
Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your Android, iPhone, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Troy, Mac Parker. Ever hear of Planet of the Apes?
The movie or the planet?
The brand new multi-million dollar musical. And you are starring as the human.
It's the part I was born to play, baby.
Wait a minute, I forgot my introduction.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and Abe is not here. He's working late. But Out Now is a film podcast with Abe and I normally discussing new movies weekly. However, every now and then we like to have these special bonus episodes, whether it be one of our fun commentaries or something completely different. And this is, in fact, one of our fun commentary episodes. We know you listeners love the commentaries, and here is going to be another info and entertainment-packed commentary episode, or edutainment, as we like to call it. It is in honor of the new release Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is hitting theaters about a week and a half from now, where you're going to talk about the 1968 original Planet of the Apes, starring Charlton Heston. And joining me to discuss this classic sci-fi film, we have Chimpanjay, Jim Dietz.
A planet where podcasters evolved from men?
And Chimpan B, Brandon Peters.
Monkey see, monkey do.
There you go. All right. So yeah, how are you guys doing?
Terrific. This is exciting.
Ape I see from Chimpan A to Chimpan Z.
There you go. Dr. Zayas, let's just jump right into this here. So yeah, this is, for anyone that's familiar, you already know what's going on. But for those that are new, this is one of our commentary episodes, meaning that Brandon and I are going to have the movie playing in the background muted so you guys can't hear it for various reasons, because that would make for an entertaining episode, and we're going to talk over it. Were you to want to play the movie yourself while listening to us talk about it, that's awesome. We're going to count it in so you can sync it up with where we are. If you're not, you're just listening, good for you. Glad you want to hear about Planet of the Apes. But with that said, Brandon, Jim, and I currently have the film at 20 seconds in, which is like after the Fox logo. And like the first image of the film is just faded in, which is just about a couple stars, and like Chuck Heston's just starting to narrate the film, like the opening. So with all that said, adjust your movie accordingly to reach where we are, and I'm going to count it down from three, and on the sound of go, we're all going to press play and just talk about the movie, Planet of the Apes. So you guys ready?
Yes.
Of course.
Okay, then, 3, 2, 1, go. All right, so Planet of the Apes is happening.
Charlton Heston or Captain Kirk? While he's in space, we should talk about this.
Because
they're both manly, you know.
What was the question?
No-shirted.
Charlton Heston or William Shatner?
Kirk or Taylor?
I go Kirk.
I mean, I'm not a Star Trek guy, so I just say Chuck Heston by default. Although, I don't know Kirk well enough, but is he just like a really mean dick to everybody else, like for no reason? Because Taylor certainly is.
He's kind of got that bravado.
Yeah, they both have that kind of exemplars of that, you know, that last flicker of American male dominance over his environment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They both kind of embody that kind of, you know, penis-led haughtiness, I guess. I don't know. Shirtless, bare-chested manliness. That was more indicative in earlier, American films, but kind of was going away by the time they came to the stage.
Well, we'll certainly get to how that's taken away from them in the second act of this movie, but for the time being.
Right.
Taylor... something I like about Harold Heston, which I just kind of pieced together as I was rewatching this film the other day, he and Tom Cruise seem like they have a lot in common. They're both big sci-fi nuts, for one thing. Between Chuck Heston, who's doing like Omega Man and this movie and Soylent Green, like he loves doing sci-fi movies, it seems, just like Tom Cruise seems to. And they just have very opinionated views on things. Chuck Heston with his NRA leadership and Tom Cruise with, you know, Scientology. Like, I, let alone, you know, the box office kind of clout they had in their, you know, heydays and whatnot. They seem like they have very similar things in common to each other. Almost make me wonder why Tom Cruise wasn't in the Planet of the Apes reboot.
Or why Tom Cruise wasn't in the I Am Legend.
Yeah, that too.
Omega. Boy, they have nice office furniture on their spaceship, don't they?
They do.
I feel like that they have a black guy and a girl, and there's like, which one do we kill off first, guys?
I think the real question we wanted was, is Heston or Wahlberg? That's the...
Oh, well, it's got to be Heston.
I think I found an ape.
I think I found an ape!
Hey, see, how do you mother ape for me?
I know, Brandon, I don't know if you've... Have you watched it yet, the
yes,
Tim Burton?
Yes.
So if you've watched it in prep... Cause
I'm
you're
fresh off of it.
Okay, so to be clear for the listener, Brandon's been doing a retrospective writing series for his site, The Naptown Nerd, on the Planet of the Apes franchise. So he's been kind of going over each movie. So you just watched the Tim Burton reboot again?
I did. I didn't own it. I went and bought it for $8. It came with a free ticket for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, or $8 cash, which would be enough to pay for my ticket here in Indiana. So it was kind of a win-win, and now I have the complete collection of Planet of the Apes movies.
Mm. I just to interrupt real quick, I like that this movie has like a 3-minute prologue of Charles Neston narrating his thoughts on space before we actually get the title sequence.
And I love that early 70s futuristic font, too.
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
Actually, I do. I mean, there are lots of things about this movie that I really... I mean, I'm sure all of us really love, which is why we're doing this commentary. But, yeah, there's a lot of just production aspects and things that evoke the time for that it's from.
Oh, yeah.
That really work and continue to work.
Since we're at the beginning and in the credits, how did everybody come into this franchise to see the first one? I think it's a... Since it's such an old... franchise that kind of went away for a good chunk of time from like 19, you know, from theatrically from like 1973 to 2001, or, you know, from the TV series, which did make like reruns in like the 80s. But how did everybody come into discovering it?
Jim? Jim?
My dad was a big Charlton Heston fan. This is one of his favorite movies by him. I grew up watching this, Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, El Cid, Omega Man, Soylent Green.
Soylent Green's a great movie.
Anytime, I love Soylent. Edward G. Robinson is really, really good in that.
When we do our Soylent Green commentary, I have plenty of stories about that one, but go on.
Sweet. but I grew up, I mean, every time this movie would be on TV, on, you know, Creature Feature, on Saturday nights, or, you know, whenever they would show it, my dad would have it on. We would watch it. So I associate this whole series with my father. And later on, when I was a little kid in the 70s, you know, they had the TV series, they had the Mego toys. It was like before Star Wars, this was like the big sci-fi franchise.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
Being a little kid in the early 70s before Star Wars came out, I think I was like 9 or 10 when Star Wars came out, but before that. I mean, this was the premier sci-fi franchise, and, you know, we had the toys, had the comics,
board games,
TV series, the cartoon, the board game. Yeah, so.
Yeah, this and, as Brandon said, this and Bond were the franchise of their day.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
This Bond and, like, Hammer Horror.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can go into my relationship with this franchise. Real quick, though, I want to point out the director, Franklin J. Schaffner. I always forget who directed Planet of the Apes, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, because he did Patton and Papillion and The Boys from Brazil. Like, there is like, this is an Academy Award-winning director. I forget that that's, like, part of this movie. I think it shows just in terms of how he handles this movie. For as far as my introduction to the series goes, I mean, obviously I'm a bit younger than Jim. I wasn't, you know, seeing these movies when I was, you know, when they're, you know, more of a presence, and I came into them at home. I can't say that I'm trying to think of, like, when the first time I saw Planet of the Apes was. It was, I think, like late 90s, because it was before I saw the Tim Burton movie, which, okay.
Well, thank God for that.
Yeah, but at the same time, I still always knew the ending of this movie, which I can't say is upsetting, even though it is one of the greatest, you know, twists in history of film. but I can't say that I'm upset about that fact. I do think it still works. I'm sure there's an impact that you just lose that you'd have, you know, when you're like seeing this movie for like the first time way back in the day. But at the same time, this movie's been spoofed so much by its ending with Spaceballs and The Simpsons, and
it's a cultural phenomenon.
It is, and it has that for a reason, because it is a classic. And but with all that said, yeah, I really like, and I was happy to see it kind of, you know, like, I think like late 90s was maybe a bit earlier, but for sure, like seeing it as a whole and remembering it, I know it from like the early 90s or mid 90s. And then the rest of the movies I saw over time as well. I think I saw the other sequels after I saw the Burton movie, but before Rise came out, certainly. I like this franchise as a whole. I am a fan of it.
Something I always wondered about, if it's airtight for space, why isn't it watertight as well?
The atmosphere clearly broke up the ship. It was a hard landing.
Okay.
That's
I always wondered about that.
We'll get to, and Brandon, I'm sure you'll point out that this is a G-rated movie.
This is a G-rated movie. Four of the five movies in the series are rated G.
But the
there's no way they'd get that nowadays.
And there's some scary stuff in here. Like, the image of that woman, like, dead and, like, mummified is, like, creepy.
Yeah, well, it was funny, you know, I forgot about that. My son, my 2.5-year-old son's been watching these with me, and he loves them, mm-hmm. apparently. Like, he always talks about watching Planet of the Apes. And when they showed that woman, I was like, oh, man. But he goes, is that an ape? I was like, yep, that's an ape. That's an ape. No, it's, yeah, and this photography out of the edge of it, oh, man. The photography in this movie, I think, is underrated. I don't think it's one thing that I see plenty of praise for this movie, but I never see, you know, some of the shots and stuff that are, like, iconic and great-looking ever get,
it fits,
you know,
well
lauded.
With how they set up the kind of the atmosphere of this film, which is, it's a mix of, yeah, this kind of photography that, for, you know, for a 60s film, or, you know, late 60s film, that you're not knowing the entire truth of, you're not knowing it's Earth necessarily, and you're just assuming you're on some planet of apes. Like, it does a good job of making the landscapes feel alien. Obviously it's shot on Earth, but the way it's presenting it to you, it combined with kind of Jerry Goldsmith's amazing score, it really gives the sense that you're watching these astronauts on a different planet moving around, and really buries the lead even when showing you the actual apes, since you don't see them for another, you know, 15 minutes or so from now.
Mm-hmm. And I think I want to point out, with you talking about the ending, Aaron,
mm-hmm.
it didn't help that the VHS and DVD covers, like, had it on the cover.
Yeah,
right.
Like, you know, I get that the movie, you know, well, everybody's seen it. Well, you know, kids grow up and they haven't seen it. That's the thing. There's a generation that follows that isn't up to speed, but I mean,
it's the same as having Soylent Green as people be such a big pop culture phrase to say.
Well, yeah, it had that quote on the box. Soylent Green is people. Which is interesting. Didn't Heston start a run of movies with this, and then he did Soylent Green and then Omega Man, like, in a row?
This was like, yeah, it's something like that, because it's similar to, like, Nick Cage doing, like, Con Air, Face Off, and The Rock all at the same time. Like, it's just like Chuck Hess was like, hey, guys, this is my plan. Yeah. Sci-fi.
I really like Omega Man, too. I mean,
yeah, Omega Man's great.
Really good. Omega Man, I put Omega Man at, like, at the bottom three of those three. But, yeah, it's certainly a fun movie. Just Chuck Heston badassing it around what is he driving in that movie?
It's a Charger, but I love the scene where, you know, he rolls Woodstock in the movie theater by himself, and he's like, they don't make him like that anymore. And like at the time it came out, I'm sure it was very poignant and timely that he said that, but you know, 30 years down the road, it makes it all the more ironic.
Here's one thing that caught on to me this time watching it was, if you remember, you know, I've been a fan of this franchise for a while, so I was always reading up on it. And during the 90s, Arnold Schwarzenegger, it was a passion project to him to remake this movie. Like, that was his goal.
Where he'd play both, both Taylor and every single ape. Curtis.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, he'd be Taylor, but I was watching this movie and I was like, man, him and Heston kind of have the same kind of presence.
Yeah, I agree.
In this movie, at least, Heston has that presence where I'm like, man, he's like Arnold without the accent. almost. I could
definitely say, got that same that physicality that Arnold has in his performance, and that kind of I don't know. Heston's delivery is just, you know, so unique. The way he just says lines, and the way he speaks his lines and delivers them. You know, that cadence is just very, you know, very singular to him. You know,
I don't know if I could see Schwarzenegger like giving shit to the other guys the way Heston does in a couple minutes here, though.
Yeah, well, I mean,
which is something because I just watched this again, so it's like fresh in my mind. I was like, Heston's really being a dick for no reason to the other guys, who, you know, promptly die in this movie, or, you know, one of them dies, the other's lobotomized.
Yeah, but I could see it.
I could see in terms of like screen presence and other things that happen in this movie for sure. I can see how
back in the '90s when I was reading about it, I was kind of like, I don't know about that, and I was like, why are you doing this, Arnold? Why, back then it was like, why waste your time remaking a classic like this? But nowadays it's par for the course.
It's okay, because Tim Burton and Mark Wahlberg did it for him.
Somehow it landed in their hands.
I want to talk about that movie later, so I just want to keep focused on Planet of the Apes for now, but I do have some things to bring up about it, so we'll get there.
Yeah, well, definitely.
I'm looking at Heston's filmography. Yeah, Planet of the Apes, 68. Beneath the Planet of the Apes, 70. Omega Man, 71. Soylent Green, 73. Something called.
He doesn't show up in Beneath the very end, though, right?
Yeah,
he's in half that movie. Like he's in it.
Well, they make you think he's in there in the opening scene, and then there's a flashback later on to explain where he went, and then he shows up in the last like 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, for him not being the lead, he's certainly in it more than I expected him to be in it when I initially watched it.
It's a weird dynamic in that movie where James Franciscus is, for all intents and purposes, our main character the whole movie, but once Heston shows up, he's just fodder.
Yeah.
And you don't care. And the guy gets, like, just coldly shot point blank in the head.
Yeah.
It's weird, too. How
in
he,
a
like,
G
follows...
movie.
Yeah. And he follows Heston's steps almost, you know, note for note and shape for shape at some points.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically, the first half of that movie is Planet of the Apes done really fast and really cheaply. And... Mm-hmm. Because all the money went into the underground stuff, which is fantastic. Once it hits a halfway mark, that's a great movie. It's just I have a hard time sitting through the first half where I'm like, who's this guy? I don't care. Where's Taylor? I mean, part of the problem is where's Taylor? And half the adventure to get to Taylor isn't that interesting because it's Taylor's adventure we already saw.
Right.
But there is a fantastic action sequence with when Franciscus is in the carriage and he climbs out and fights an ape to take control of it. That's a pretty good sequence, but it's just kind of just TikTok. Where are we going? We've seen this. And then it gets insanely interesting. It flip pops and becomes just about as good as this movie, pretty much.
And once they, you know, go beneath the Planet of the Apes. Yeah.
Yeah. Once they do what the title tells you they're going to do, which always felt, as I keep watching it, it feels like it's a quicker journey to Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I always felt like,
oh yeah, you just
it took
get
so long to get there, but now,
with the film.
Yeah, when I was doing it this time, I was clocking the time, and it's about dead center of the movie that they enter.
This is what I'm talking about. This movie, like, has to, like, he's just so mean. He seems like the other guy for no reason. He's like, he's chiding him for you know, wanting to have emotion over the fact that everything he knew is now gone. Well, Heston's like taking it with stride, and the guy's like planting an American flag, and Heston's like, ha, that's the stupidest thing you could have done right now. Like, he's just being a dick.
Well, I think it's, you know, reality hasn't set in for him.
Well, even then, like, you look at, like, the beginning of this film, and it seems like he's waxing poetic about space, the final frontier, however you want to call it. Like, he seems like he's a fairly reasonable guy, but then he's just like, ha, now the other guys are awake, and I'm going to make fun of them. Ha! Like,
he's the boss. But he also, I mean, if he's a guy going on a space mission like this, I mean, he's cold hard and left what behind? Probably nothing. Probably just himself. His life's a mission. I don't know. Yeah, he is being a dick, yes.
Well, in the unwanted prequel reboot of Planet of the Apes that has Taylor's early life on Earth, like, we'll see how that goes, I guess.
Oh, boy.
But Jim's favorite is Beneath, right?
Yeah, second half of Beneath, Church of the Almighty Bomb and all that good stuff, Victor Buono and all that.
When you say favorite, you mean favorite of the sequels?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You know, did you guys know the funny thing about Beneath? The sets are actually the same sets used for Hello, Dolly, just done post-apocalyptic.
Huh.
Because Fox was trying to, you know, cut corners, save money. So that was already built, so it didn't have to go in the budget, and they just, you know, made it.
That would have made WALL-E a totally different movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of Escape from the Planet of the Apes, the third movie in the franchise.
That's a good one, too.
It's like one of the most popular, probably the most popular sequel of all of the original canon.
People like Conquest, Conquest. People
Conquest
like that.
Wasn't cool to like till later. I like Conquest before it was cool.
Yeah, but it still seems like it's winning now. Like, it seems like that's the one that gets brought up the most.
With having Rise around, I mean, that definitely helps build it.
Before that, though, like, I was feeling the Conquest love when I was rewatching all these movies and kind of reading about them. That's kind of the impression I got. But
fair enough. Growing up, though, Escape was always the popular one because it was fun. It was like Star Trek IV for the Apes movies.
Is that the whales?
Yeah, that's the whales.
I'm going to guess that every time someone brings up a Star Wars movie or Star Trek movie. I never actually know.
That one, like, you could ask your grandma about Star Trek IV, and she'd know about Star Trek IV, but, you know, because it was the accessible. I mean, there was an accessibility to it.
Don't ask me, because I wouldn't know.
So. I know. But it seemed like back then, I don't, nowadays probably not, but back from, like, you know, the 80s and the 90s, if you asked about a Star Trek movie, they probably knew about Star Trek IV. With Chekhov going looking for the nuclear vessels and
over Khan? Over Ricardo Montalban?
Yeah, over Khan.
Okay.
Star Trek IV did, like, over $100 million at the box office. People weren't even into Star Trek, so I'll try Star Trek IV. Khan's a better movie, but
if Khan hadn't been a success, that franchise would have never gotten a third movie.
What did three
right,
do?
No,
the first movie bombed so horribly and so hugely and cost so much money and made almost none of it back that if Khan had not been the rousing success that it was, that franchise would have just died on the vine until it got rebooted.
This sounds exactly like Firefly. Firefly gets canceled. Firefly gets a movie. It bombs horribly. As soon as we get Firefly 2, I'm sure it will just take off from there, right?
If it has Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah, yes.
I wasn't saying the quality or that Khan wasn't a success. It's just that, like, the public got into Star Trek IV for some reason. Like, people who weren't Star Trek people got into Star Trek.
Right.
That was my...
Getting back to this movie, what's at hand, this is what and what you were pointing out earlier, Brendan, about just kind of the cinematography and, like, the shots. I mean, you're looking at this world that's obviously, you know, obviously, again, it's not like we're filming on other planets, we're filming on Earth, but just we're presenting this natural environment, which is, where is it shot, like Utah? Is that, like, a lot of it?
Looks like it. I'm pretty sure it's in Monument Valley.
Monument, Arizona. Okay, I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, near Grand Canyon, Colorado River, Lake Powell. So yeah, a lot of Midwest, Southwest kind of areas to provide just barren landscapes to represent the Forbidden Zone. And it looks like it could be another planet. Like, not being told that initially, just being told, like, if you're walking into the movie the first time called Planet of the Apes, and you're looking at this, like, yeah, all right, they're on a different planet. Like,
I first watched it, I thought this was a different planet. I never once thought Earth was going to be the answer. So it was a shocking twist.
Here's a question.
Like
No.
You make a really good point about the cinematography, though, because we get a lot of long shots on these guys as they're moving through the environment. They're really making the environment part of the story, and, you know, by making it part of the composition of the shot. I mean, instead of giving us a regular two shot of these guys talking, you know, where we get like a static two shot, where, you know, we're getting this tracking shot where you get to see, you know, the environment as part of the story and definitely part of, you know,
you wouldn't get this nowadays at all.
Oh my god, people would have no patience for this.
No,
like, there's,
and it's, I love this stuff.
Yeah, there's so much setup in this movie. There's so many, like, yeah, just like shots of nothing happening. Like,
we would have met up with the apes by now.
I mean, to be fair, and I haven't seen Dawn of the Planet of the Apes yet, but what I'm hearing is that, you know, you're gonna get pretty much this kind of stuff in that movie, just with only apes and, like, and no talking for the most part for, like, the first 20 minutes at least. So, I mean, it's, like, they're certainly trying to evoke things that made this movie work so well. But yeah, I mean,
well, from what I hear, like, Reeves really had a handle on what the apes movies were.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were worried about him, a new director taking over after Rise. But I was like, when I heard Matt Reeves, I was like, got it.
Oh yeah. That's,
they got it. I'd almost want them, I know he's going to do the follow-up, but I almost want them to switch hands again just to
see the different, you know, different take on it.
Because these, I mean, up until 4 and 5, they had a different director each one.
Who did Beneath?
Ted Post, who did Magnum Force.
There we go. Okay. Here's a question. When you're watching the Tim Burton one for the first time, and I saw that in theaters, like, opening weekend.
Yep.
were you assuming that it was going to be Earth? Spoilers for Planet of the Apes, Tim Burton 2001 edition.
I didn't, you know, I think I might have read somewhere that it wasn't.
It's like you already knew.
Or so, before it came. I think they were trying to establish that they were going more off the book from which this is based, wasn't.
Book, yeah, the book is not.
But I think in the back of my mind, I was like, maybe they were just throwing some, you know, smoke for pulling the same old twist, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that the whole thing of it being Earth is attributed to Rod Serling's rewriting
the
script.
Because they brought him in. Yeah, they brought the Twilight Zone master in to tweak it. And
well, even with the ending of the book and the Tim Burton version, there is a Twilight Zone-esque aspect to that ending as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I see what you're saying for sure, having Rod Serling around to adapt the screenplay for Planet of the Apes. Yeah, it gives a new light to it. But yeah, I was definitely thinking, okay, they're going to be on Earth, right? And that was just not, and that's not even a thing that made me, you know, dislike that movie. And there's many reasons I dislike Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, but yeah, that wasn't one of them. That was just more of like a head scratcher thrown on top of the fact that I already didn't like this movie.
Yeah.
I'd have to go with Abraham Lincoln being my biggest.
Oh,
well, yeah, that's where I was scratching my head.
Yeah.
I mean, we could all agree that Tim Roth's fantastic in that movie, but still, there's nothing else really going on. And even Danny Elfman's score, he kind of tries in Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, hey, that score's not bad. Yeah. I like the opening, the credit scoring and stuff. The other stuff's more traditional blockbuster sounding.
Yeah, that's kind of Elfman in mid-2000s.
No, it's funny. Who'd have thought summer 2001 that if you'd have thought then that one of the movies coming out would spawn a 7-film franchise would be Planet of the Apes or Fast and Furious, you'd have thought it was
Planet
of the Apes.
Yeah. I mean, the makeup's fantastic, but that just comes with the territory of technology. The
makeup's fantastic. It's got some great sets, but they look like sets.
Yeah.
That's a big problem with that movie. I feel like I'm watching it like a making of a 1960s, 50s sci-fi movie.
I was super excited about that movie too.
Oh no, I was like a top movie to see that.
I was watching all the behind the scenes stuff, looking at all Rick Baker's work, like he was giving interviews and everything. I was like, and like I like Mark Wahlberg, like I love Boogie Nights, like I was on the Wahlberg
Tim
train.
Tim Burton, he can't go
and
wrong.
Tim Burton's coming off of he's coming off Sleepy Hollow, which is my favorite Tim Burton movie. So I'm like, all of this sounds amazing.
This is before he left a whole bunch of smoldering franchises wrecked on the highway as he tried to reboot them.
And the cast, like Helena Bonham Carter, Michael Clark Duncan, Paul Giamatti.
I mean, it was Wahlberg's first big movie, wasn't it?
In fact, Entourage's second season, based around Aquaman, is supposed to mirror the life Mark Wahlberg had when he was considering starting a Planet of the Apes. Like, that's the idea behind that. That and, like, Perfect Storm at the same time.
He went on to Rockstar, right?
Yep. Yeah.
These were actually in the Burton one.
Damn your scarecrows. I love that, and I love the music cue. Like, stuff's so good in here.
Great. Yeah, we're still with these guys, and no apes 25 minutes into the film. That would not happen nowadays.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. Wahlberg. Boogie Nights. The big hit. My favorite guilty pleasure of all time. Three Kings. Like he's killing it right now in the 90s.
Well, you know what's funny, too, is, you know, we may be like 25 minutes in, no apes. We're still going to go a couple more minutes without apes. The trailers for these things were like, back in the day, were like super spoilery, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the film would still take its time. You know, because I don't think, if you saw a trailer, you saw it in the theater, you had no way to keep seeing it.
Exactly, that's what it comes down to. That's why it's easy to forgive trailers from back in the day as opposed to now, or they're doing the same thing. Like, people want to complain that trailers nowadays give away everything. It's like, well, that hasn't changed. It's always been like that. It's just now you have YouTube, and you have every means you can to see trailers again and again and again and again, which is, again, your choice. So it's like everyone's necessarily forcing this upon you either. But yeah, when you see a trailer of the movie in the 70s, when you see like a trailer for Jaws, and you get a lot of Jaws without seeing the actual shark, which is why it's a great trailer, you get a sense of what that movie is. So, you know, 6 months later or whenever, when you actually see the movie, you're like, oh yeah, all right, this is that movie I was going to see. Like, you have a familiarity, but you're not feeling spoiled on it.
Yeah, like the trailer for the original Halloween is like, why did you show all this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this they go swimming, right?
Yeah. Island.
Swimming. I had a friend of mine, an older friend of mine, tell me that this was the first time that Less she saw
G movie.
This is the first time that she saw male rear end when she saw this movie in the theaters.
Well, you know what's, oh man, another great thing. This came out the same year as 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, and my big
great sci-fi movies.
My biggest issue with Planet of the Apes is the fact that it won a makeup award in Planet of the Apes, and in 2001 didn't, because those apes look amazing in 2001. This is like, all right, they're fine, but come on, like they look like apes in 2001. Like I'm hard convinced to like pick out the ones that aren't real, and they're all not real. Like it's crazy.
A part of that's the acting too.
I could talk all day about how much respect 2001 deserved when it came out and it didn't get it.
I mean, these are two like sci-fi masterpieces that just work on the same levels and different levels all at the same time.
Yeah,
that's what I love about them. And then like what, Solaris came out like a couple years later, right?
Mm-hmm. I think Solaris is like 73 maybe.
And it kind of falls in the category of like feeling like these movies.
Oh, shoot. No, it's... it is 72. There's another Solaris in 68, but that's not it. That's some other thing.
In the, in the 70s, you also got all those really goofy sci-fi movies, too, like Zardoz.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Zardoz.
And Logan's Run.
Well, even like Omega Man is, I consider, a mm-hmm. goofy sci-fi movie.
Oh, yeah.
compared to this.
Yeah. Logan's Run was like the last of them, right? Because shortly after Star Wars came. And
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and just changed everything.
Logan's Run won tons of technical awards, right?
I can look that up, and I'm pretty sure you're correct on that one. But yeah, Star Wars and like Alien, I mean, they brought in that, you know, that grittier sci-fi where where everything was
used space.
Thank you. Right. Used space, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you got Star Trek the Motion Picture that came out in 1979, trying to go back to like the 2001 stuff.
Like, no, we got this now. We're good. It got Special Academy. Logan's Run won a Special Academy Award. It got nominated for cinematography and art direction.
Okay.
Logan's Run's a fun one.
I love
one.
That movie.
That's a fun. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I like. That's one where I could see a remake. This happened already?
Brian Singer had it for a while. And
Him and Matt Damon,
and then it was him and Gosling.
McQuarrie had it. For
actually,
a while.
I heard that Ken Levine from BioShock wrote a treatment.
Yep,
for a remake of Logan's Run, and that was one of the reasons he, after BioShock Infinite, they stripped down Irrational Games to a much smaller crew or whatever, so he could work on that.
And that's essentially what is Andrew Niccol of Truman Show fame. He did in Time, and that movie has, I think, that has a lot indebted to Logan's Run.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not a good movie. But so.
Back when Michael York could open your movie.
Yeah, I mean, he is Michael York is Logan. Yeah.
A lot of people know him as just Basil Exposition in the Austin Powers movies.
Right.
I mean, he was big with like Logan's Run and Cabaret back in the...
Cabaret, yeah. What's the other thing? There's something else. Didn't he have like a
Three Musketeers.
Three Musketeers. Okay.
He was
Still no apes, by the way. We're about half an hour in the movie.
And this is... the reveal is so great, too.
It is.
It's like a terrifying reveal.
And that goes with Goldsmith's music. I mean, the score is so good in this movie.
Yeah, it really puts you in the position of these astronauts when you see the ape for the first time. And everybody's dirty except that one hottie.
Mm-hmm.
Nova.
Keeping it clean. Her hair's a bit mussed, though, so, you know.
Still ratted out, though.
I love how big Charlton Heston's teeth are, by the way. It's like they're almost comically large. Like they're just about there. Like that's how big his teeth are.
Don't quite fit in his mouth.
He is just like, you know, he's one of those presences that just, I mean, larger than life. No matter what he does, he's going to command the screen.
And it's no wonder he can chew the scenery. He has teeth that big.
He literally chews it.
I love that.
He cameoed in the Tim Burton one, right?
He did. As an ape that doesn't want to use guns. That makes it even better.
And then he quotes his last line in this movie, I think, before, and then dies. And it's just a ridiculous scene.
Yeah, but Tim Roth's there, so that makes it.
Yeah, cool. Tim Roth's there. Yeah.
Like I give Tim Roth so much credit for making.
Tim Roth totally methoded that movie.
Yeah. Like I'm sure he like Andy Serkis did and like lived with apes for months at a time before doing Planet of the Apes.
Well, you know Tim Roth he resigned the role of Snape in the Harry Potter movies to do Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes.
Oh, I'm sure Alan Rickman laughs at him.
Yeah.
From a distance. He just calls him on the phone. Hello, Mr. Roth.
And at the time, I still think it's the wrong decision. Even, like, you're going to be in this popular young adult book adaptation that has, you know, franchise potential for, what, 7 films, at least, at the time.
Maybe they were just both puzzled by they didn't get the Lord of the Rings call, so they just chose whatever.
That's true.
Now we have 32 minutes in.
Yeah.
We see our first ape.
And this music's so good. I love this score so much.
Chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. No other monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget. I think it was Roddy McDowall used to be famous for telling the story that when they would have like meal breaks or whatever, like the gorillas would all sit together and the orangutans would all sit together and the chimps would all sit together, you know, which I thought was pretty humorous.
That is something I like about Rise quite a bit, and that what seems to be carrying forward in Dawn as well, that they have those factions still. They do have orangutans, and they do have gorillas, and they do have chimpanzees, and just leave it at that. I like Taylor's jump right here. It gets away from that net. Glad corn's still, you know, a good product in the future. Like that didn't like it go extinct or whatever.
I've never seen a monkey eat corn before.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the apes have really harnessed the power of cornfields yet, even though they're growing. I like the stunt work here with this big hill. There's some cool, like, people falling down and, like, oh.
Yeah.
It's like, you think about that for a second. It's like, oh, yeah, people are, you know, risking their lives to, like, break ankles or whatnot just so they can fall off these little hills.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think one of the major problems with Tim Burton's film is from the outset, before you even go shoot the movie, it's doomed because this is just one thing you can't replicate with this, you know, what this movie does. Because it's because of the phenomenon it was.
I mean, I think if given that it has that different ending, like I think if the movie was just better written or better handled overall, there could have been potential to do. I mean, Rise is obviously doing so. I mean, it's a completely different way to do it.
I mean,
it came
at a different time, though. So at the time, I mean, reboot wasn't really a thing. It was more like you had to sort of remake. It had to resemble the original in some way at the time.
And you really, I mean, you get the sense of chaos. I mean, the camera really tightens up in these scenes. It's a lot closer to the characters.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a lot closer to the action than we saw in, you know, the big expanses that we're in before. And really, like, after having those big wide shots, bringing these tighter, you know, close-up shots in really, I mean, brings out the action and the terror, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, we're just watching, like, this foreign thing happen where, like, people are running away from these creatures that,
It's just beating him with a gun barrel in the water. I didn't notice that before. Oh, jeez.
Yep, took one in the neck.
Somebody's falls
bright eyes.
I'm saying the stunt works really good in this scene.
That is not deep water.
Yeah. And people are all, you know, it's crowded. Like people are probably falling all over each other.
Taylor.
The other thing. And this is something that's obviously been solved to an extent, and that all those people were dead. That's a lot of imagery. Something that's been solved by having these, you know, these reboot films with the, you know, computer, the CG apes that look amazing. In 68, like the makeup, you know, it is what it is. It's fine. Like I'm not gonna say dated's a word to use, but I wouldn't say that really applies. It's more that's what you had to work with, but if you're watching this movie for the first time and you're seeing this, I don't think you have any. Would you think that this is supposed to represent what apes are supposed to look like and not just be like some kind of weird humanoid version of apes on a different planet?
I always took it as it was like an they were evolved.
Right.
To somehow be that way. I never took them as this is just apes. I always took them as like an
evolved version of apes.
And it helps for the mystique of you thinking this is another planet.
Exactly. That's
That's what it helps too. But I never heard till like recently people being like, "Oh my gosh, these were supposed to look like apes." And I'm like, "Well, I never ever took it that way. I always took it as like this was an evolution. This is a planet that maybe evolved differently.
Or apes evolved from men, maybe.
Yeah, or the apes evolved. Yeah, the apes evolved from men, or you know, something like that. And then I think with Conquest, they try to show that.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, that's
right.
When
they,
I watch,
they,
yeah,
they
when
breed
I
the apes for servitude and stuff.
When I revisit, well, obviously Escape does that too, just by having the time travel thing thrown in there. I mean, Conquest emphasizes that by showing the kind of progression and then you get to battle. But yeah, that was something that I kind of picked up on when I was rewatching the sequels. Like, yeah, I guess they are supposed to be apes. It's just,
yeah.
But yeah, that makes sense to me, Brandon. Yeah, kind of an evolved version, which makes me wonder if these prequels keep going, or, you know, whatever, this new franchise keeps going, Rise and Dawn, like what the end game could be, if there's like a giant time jump that leads to, you know, thousands of years from now, like this movie, and kind of tries to do that again.
And I, you know, with the makeup and stuff, this is fantastic. I mean, this is absolutely groundbreaking work here. And so, I'm of the mind that when you watch a film from 1968, 1969, that you need to watch it with the mindset of 1968, 1969 and know the limitations and not hold modern day attributes to a movie made then. You know?
I mean, you say that, but 2001: A Space Odyssey was pretty good looking apes.
I
think what's also kind of amazing is with the layers and layers of makeup on, how much acting they're able to do, and how much you're able to express and get across with that much makeup on. I mean, Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowall Maurice Evans and stuff.
Yeah, they're able to emote quite well.
It's a shame that the sequels have lower budgets and the costumes don't necessarily suffer. It's just they don't get to improve.
They're reused. Pretty much. But
well, they don't get to
2001. The apes aren't required to act.
True.
Like
yeah.
Humans.
Very true. Yes. I completely get that aspect of it. By the way, so now we're in the second act of this movie. I need to point this out because I've been riding Heston on how much of a dick he's been, but it makes complete sense when you get to this, where it's basically the most frustrating position he can possibly be in, where he has all the intelligence he needs, but he cannot communicate that in any other way. So it's just like watching Heston not be able to talk while everyone's just mocking him. It's really like,
and he looks like just another human when he's trying to do this stuff.
Yes. If there's any reason that, like, keeps me from, like, putting Planet of the Apes as, like, an all-time favorite, it's because I'm so frustrated by this act of the movie. It's just like, there he is. He can't talk. And he's just, like, being held back from doing something just makes me so upset in so many ways. It's ridiculous.
Well, the movie's working for you, then.
It is. It's doing that, but it's still, like, it's a weird primal emotion, Brandon. It's hard to grasp in a way that's more positive. Even though I do like all this stuff with Kim Hunter and everybody.
Kim Hunter's like terrific. She's like kind of one of the hearts of the series. But I mean, Roddy McDowall gets known, but
it's part of why I like Escape so much. It's so tragic,
and it's mainly her star. I mean, Cornelius is there, but she's, I think, truly the star.
She's the one having the kid.
When she gets she gets to do the fun stuff. She gets the grape juice plus. She has the kid. She seems to be the one they want to focus on learning all the 1970s culture things.
But then has that such a tragic ending. I really like Escape because I like that kind of fish out of water stuff. Even though this movie is technically doing that as well,
It works. Yeah, exactly. It's logical to go there.
Obviously, I like Planet of the Apes is the favorite of all of us between in this franchise. But yeah, in terms of the sequels, I really like that stuff. Escape, but Conquest is fun. I like Conquest. It's just dark. I get what they're doing, but it's like it's one that like I don't feel like watching as much as I like watching Escape.
Fair enough. No, like Escape, I think it's a brilliant move that they made. I mean, you have to give it that they went back in time. That's just the one thing they ask you to do. But for a series, like a franchise is worth, if Iron Man is made back in 1968, 69, this is, the first one's 68, right?
Yes.
Okay, if Iron Man's made in 1968 and it's a big hit, when they go to make Iron Man 2, they don't double the budget, they cut it.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they did it back then, because a sequel would have diminishing returns. And that's what we'll keep. It was kind of like milking it, but each sequel was expected to make a little
less. What about the
Bond
movies?
That's a different thing. It was owned by a family.
Fair, okay, yeah.
And that just wouldn't quit. But a lot of sequels were seen as diminishing returns. So every time a new Apes film came, okay, cut the budget, go do another one. All right, this one came in, cut the budget again.
In the later movies and stuff like that.
Yeah, and they kept making less money too. So I mean, it was just following. It wasn't until like the last decade or so that sequels started making money, becoming, better film. Like it used to be, sequels suck. And they're always inferior films, but now we live in an age now where they're besting with consistency.
I mean, sequels then too, where they were made for money. Like I really, well,
yeah.
I mean, it's hard to say that, but sometimes. But at the same time, it does seem like if you're making a sequel to movies back then, it's entirely because of money. Like
Well, making Beneath the Planet of the Apes was huge back then. They just didn't make sequels. I mean, that was getting a sequel was a big deal if you weren't James Bond, or like you know Hammer Horror. Getting a sequel was a big deal, and you know when Beneath was a hit, they went to Escape and said, "Okay, we'll do another one after this." So set us up. Escape was the only one made where they were planning on doing another one, but it's how they went. And Escape, the brilliance of that was the budget got cut again from Beneath, and they just said they put it in modern times, so they would only have to have practically two apes for the whole movie to do that makeup on, which was, you know, a big cost, and they could just have it in modern times and not have to focus on sets. They could just shoot on locations or already built sets on studio lots, and, you know.
This was hugely expensive for the time when it was made. I mean, considering, you know, like you said, we said before, the state-of-the-art makeup, the sets, all the on-location shooting, you know, A-list actor like Heston, things like that. I mean, this...
Yeah.
I don't think Fox really expected this to make as much and to be as successful as it was.
No. And also, yeah, I mean, this is so expensive. This little city they have,
which looks
town
like
with apes, you won't see again in Beneath. You'll think you saw it again, but you don't.
This town looks like bedrock from the Flintstones, by the way.
It's definitely
adorable, these two.
Great chemistry.
I completely forgot that Kris Kristofferson was in Planet of the Apes.
That's right, yeah, for two lines in 3 minutes. I was like, what's he even doing here?
He's always wanted to work with Estella Warren. That was the...
That's right.
In the early 70s, by law, you had to have Kristofferson in your movie at some point.
He had all that Blade clout going on. So.
You know, what's a cool thing that the Planet of the Apes franchise has that comes with some bigger franchises, they, you know, speaking of Escape, they kind of have a trilogy within its own, like, full franchise. Like, Escape, Conquest, and Battle can really hold on their own as their own little trilogy.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, series like Halloween has, like, those Jamie Lloyd movies where there's, like, three movies in there. Like,
exactly like that, yeah.
Friday the 13th has the Tommy Jarvis trilogy. Star Trek has, you know, two, three, and four, which hold together. Elm Street's got theirs. Planet Apes has theirs. It's kind of an interesting thing.
A way to go, Nova.
And here we go, Dr. Zaius, or Dr. Naysayus, as I call him.
Dr. Zaius. And what's cool is Dr. Zaius is an iconic character, too, that came from this.
Yeah, he's also a dick.
Yeah, he's also a dick. But, I mean, he's super well-known. You could say Dr. Zaius.
Yeah, because it's an awesome name, and he has a sweet coat. Like, he's the Shaft of Ape Town. I'll give him that.
There you go.
And to be fair, I mean, Maurice Evans is great at playing condescending assholes. He really is.
Yeah. Our Shaft commentary, by the way, we got to do that one at some point.
Oh, nice. Yes.
Shaft and 2000 Shaft as well. I like that movie.
That commentary would be
Shaft's
one
big
bad
score's
mother.
Not bad either.
Shaft has a great score, yeah.
Well, no, I meant big score, his second one.
Oh, Shaft's big score, okay.
Yeah.
We don't have to talk about Shaft in Africa. That's we don't either.
No. Yeah,
I need to
go. Let that one go, huh?
This is going to be a... God, I don't even know if I want to go into such a crazy tangent, but I'll just real quick. Shaft. I saw a movie called Airplane vs. Volcano, starring friend of the show Jimmy O from JoeBlow.com. Not starring, but he's in it. Stars Dean Cain. It's fine. But there's a black air marshal in that movie on the airplane. He's played by Freddie Boom Boom Washington from Welcome Back, Kotter.
Nice.
Something I found out from the directors I was talking to about that movie, Freddie Boom Boom Washington, he was supposed to be Shaft. After Roundtree, and they were going to make sequels in the TV series, they auditioned him a lot to be Shaft because Roundtree was apparently not the best person to be working with, but he kept coming back, so they kept having him as Shaft. But they kept having Freddie Boom Boom Washington as the alternate. Like, he was going to be it. And his career probably could have been a lot bigger if he was Shaft.
See, if I remember, Lawrence Hilliard Jacobs, right?
Yes, yeah, there you go. I'm trying to remember his name. But it's easier to say Freddie Boom Boom Washington. All right, that concludes our mini Shaft commentary. Back to Planet of the Apes.
Well, that's interesting because Snipes is who they wanted. before Jackson got the role.
I see Jackson as Shaft more than Snipes.
I can see Snipes.
After Blade 3, I can't see Snipes.
It was before Blade 3.
So. Okay, I was going to say. I could see Snipes walking up to an all-you-can-eat
bar. I'm thinking about 90s Snipes now. I can actually see him as Shaft. I can see, like,
he would be the easiest option A to think of.
I am so consumed by Snipes from the Blade era that I forget about kind of 90s.
Pasture 57, Boiling Point, Rising Sun. White Man Can't Jump.
I forget.
Snipes turned it down.
New Jack City. Yeah.
Still one of my favorite insults in any movie.
Which one's that?
Sit your $5 ass down before I decide to make change. Snipes in New Jack City.
Oh, there's some.
Thank God they speak English on the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's called the common tongue.
One little detail about this movie that when I little young Brandon watching it really caught with him was that Taylor is from Fort Wayne, Indiana, which was where I was born and raised.
Okay.
So I was like, and I'd never seen it mentioned in a movie before.
And your parents called you Bright Eyes for the longest time.
Yes, they did. I just didn't understand that. But yeah, it was pretty interesting first time watching. I was like, what? Fort Wayne, Indiana?
What do you think the third Planet of the Apes movie is going to be called after Dawn?
What are they going to... Is it going to be Fresh Territory? Because isn't Dawn supposed to be kind of like what Rise did for Conquest, this one does for Battle?
I mean, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
They're not direct remakes, but they certainly have that backing to them, it seems.
I guess it depends on where the movie ends.
Midnight of the Planet of the Apes.
I've been told...
Mid-afternoon.
It's very... in tune with the Apes series, with how it ends.
Tea time with the Planet of the Apes.
Brunch of the Planet of the Apes.
There it is. Done. Got it. Get your hands off my sausage, you damn dirty ape. And pass the orange juice.
Or mimosa. You burned my eggs, Benedict, all to hell!
Ah. It's a combination of me being frustrated that he can't talk and everyone being so stubborn around him when he's writing things and doing so many things that are smart.
Well, I mean, it's kind of the mentality that Dr. Zaius has put upon this community, being ignorant and hiding things.
Well, you've got the orangutans, they're kind of the hierarchy and the religious right, kind of, who are kind of trying to keep it away. You know, the lawgiver is the law and all that kind of stuff. You have the militant wing, the gorillas, and then you have the scientists and the intellectuals, who are the chimpanzees. So,
they're also the protesters.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to give credit because Roddy McDowall didn't return for the second Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
But the guy who fills in for him does a pretty good job of making it kind of feel seamless.
Yeah. I do like when he asks for a map, and he's like, yeah, all right. And then he's kind of traipse over, and he's been his rags and everything.
I do think, do you guys think the apes are born with their fashion sense? Because when they go from Conquest to Battle, they are wearing this. They have the same clothing, color schemes, and clothing as they do in this movie.
I question the wisdom of like wool and leather gherkins in a subtropical climate. You know? Considering they already have a big layer of fur underneath, one would assume.
Life finds a way.
That's got to smell like a batch of bad ape.
Do they have ape colognes? I feel like that's handled in Escape.
But they have to smell. Yeah, it's called 99 Bananas.
Jesus. Doesn't Zira like go to like a beauty shop and like get colognes and stuff on her? And yeah,
she gets like yeah. There's a section with that. Somewhere in this during this, Dr. Milo is searching and finding Taylor's craft and making it work to travel through time.
Yeah.
That's the movie they need to make. What was going on with Dr. Milo during this?
He scoured the sea. he found the parts he needed to replace.
Suppose I could make this into a time machine. Yeah. No, and it's interesting that Caesar's real name is Milo. He has to go by Caesar to, you know, keep it secret that he's not Zero and Cornelius's child, which is an interesting aspect.
Yeah, that's actually...
Whereas in Rise, he's straight up Caesar.
Yeah. I forget to think about the John Connor, Kyle Reese logic of Planet of the Apes series, apparently.
You know, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, that script was going around for a long time. Like, when I lived in L.A., that was, like, a hot script going around. It was just called Caesar.
Yeah,
it was a remake of Conquest, which was interesting. Like, let's remake the fourth movie. And, I kind of knew it was going to be a success. There was such, like, positive buzz going on about the script. And then it came out and people seemed kind of hesitant. But I was like, yeah, I think this is going to be really good. I've heard nothing but good things about it. And they got good people involved. And, hey, it was even better than I thought it would be.
Yeah, we talked about this off air a bit, but I was just super jazzed. I was like, I was in on the idea of like Caesar. Okay, it's like a riot. So we're getting the story of how these apes came to power, and then circus is involved, and got the mocap stuff. Like this sound, and then I remember like the set, whatever embargo dropped, and like all the set release press stuff came out like in January when the movie was coming out in like what July of 2010, 2011. Yeah. And I got super excited. I'm seeing all this footage, and the ape looked great, and everything. It's like, I'm putting some eggs in the basket on this one.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it just delivered. I was really happy.
It was the best movie that summer.
That and, like, what, X-Men First Class, I guess? I mean,
there's those two. And, for some reason I knew it was going to work. Because you can't, Tim Burton's proved, like, hey, making the first one again is not going to work. You're not going to make a sequel to Tim Burton's. Remaking Escape, it doesn't work without kind of having its predecessors. So, I mean, I guess Conquest was perfect to start.
I know when I heard that was where they were going with it and everything, I was kind of dubious. I'm like, really? That's the one they're going to go with next to remake or whatever? But, I mean, it was incredible. It's probably my favorite James Franco movie.
Over Spring Breakers?
Yeah, Spring Breakers and 127 Days.
I think he's great in 127 Hours. I'm the person that thinks Franco's not very good in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's my flaw with the movie.
Actually. Yeah. Well, he's kind of overshadowed by Circus.
Lithgow's really good, too.
Lithgow's good. I mean, we can talk about that, but the human stuff in Apes in Rise bothers me. It's the reason that I don't love that movie, or I don't overly love that movie, I guess. I really like Rise of the Planet of the Apes quite a bit. I think it's a very good movie. But there's just stuff about the human plot that gets weaker every time I see it compared to the ape stuff, which gets stronger every time I see it.
I think for me, like, Franco's pretty much Franco in every movie I see him in. And in that one, he seemed like it fit him most. I don't know. Other than maybe Pineapple Express. Oh, there's the lawgiver.
Mm-hmm. Later played by John Huston? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, right.
It's one of the weirdest casting bits in the entire series is John Huston as the lawgiver.
It's super sad.
In a movie that had, like, no budget.
He was trying to control the water, Brandon.
Yeah. He was also in the movie the Bermuda Triangle near the end of his life. I mean, he really was running out of money there at the end. He was trying to raise money to do a new film, and that's why he was pretty much in, you know, he's in all these low-budget things at the end of his life.
I guess.
And Chinatown.
Me thinking of, like, the legendary John Huston. Battle for the Planet, like just like an Orson Welles towards the end of his, I mean, he was voicing
Unicron,
Galvatron, or Unicron.
Unicron. Yeah.
And being thought of for Yodorovsky's Dune.
Yeah.
As long as they fed him appropriately.
We've all seen this. Right. We've all seen that movie now at this point. Yodorovsky's Dune. That is a good documentary.
Oh yeah. I'd recommend.
Yeah.
The Planet of the Apes commentary recommends Yodorovsky's.
I wish they would just animate those storyboards.
Right.
And make, you know, like, we'll animate the storyboard version of his Dune. I mean, I would watch that.
This chase is hilarious to me. I think it's so like it's so like clunky and weird. With
kind of redo it in Burton's
with Heston's like raggedy clothes that he's wearing. And like nets are like the least effective thing ever apparently when it comes to Charlton Heston because he cannot stay in a net.
And that's not Charlton Heston jumping down.
Obviously.
The guy didn't even have a beard.
And it makes me question the use of these steps in this whatever this amphitheater is supposed to be. It's like, what is this? Like, what is this set design?
Now, later when they had the TV series, I think they did end up using parts of the same city for that because it looks, unless they rebuilt it.
I think they rebuilt it because they did not, they didn't, all they used was the amphitheater for Beneath.
Hmm.
That's the only time, because every time, because Franciscus goes into Zira and Cornelius's home, but you never see the outside of it, and then they have a speech part at the amphitheater, and there's a little protest they run into on a road. But they're really clever with making you think that you see this city again, but you don't. Mm-hmm. There's a butt again.
Yeah, when Taylor runs over the camera like that, and it kind of follows him. That's my Battle of Algiers moment. That's what I think of when I see that shot. It's like, oh, now we're down and gritty in the Apes Town.
Oh, here comes some creepy stuff.
Like yes, very much. This is like House of Wax.
Why did no one build a rail? That's what I'm wondering.
Apes climb everything. Why?
That's true.
They run.
There's
they run
no OSHA on the planet of the apes.
They probably don't even use those stairs half the time. They probably just climb up. The rails just get in the way. Completely bedrock. That's everything I see in this every time.
It does look like bedrock.
But I am convinced that Frankel Schaffner, like he's like, that's my Battle of Algiers moment right there. Just put it down in the middle.
Hold still.
And then
Freed
can try to one up Planet of the Apes later on. With French connections. It's like, I'll make it gritty. I'll show
you. I'm sure that's what he was thinking too. It was the first thing in Friedkin's mind. You know.
This is creepy.
It is so creepy. Rated G.
They just stuffed him. He just died.
And yeah, it is like a. It is him standing still. That makes it more eerie, actually, the fact that it's like not a model, but it's just the actual guy. Because they couldn't do a model for it.
Now, injuring his throat more helps him end up being able to talk.
Yeah.
No, but after his throat healed, and it's actually better and stronger and faster than before. Throat spit faster, by the way, that's true.
The score is great.
Yep.
You're zooming on the teeth.
I'm really hoping for like a trail of alligators for Taylor to run over at some point to escape all
this. No,
he's not. He's not Roger Moore. Come on.
I think that's one of my earliest Bond memories. By the way, Live and Let Die, him running over the alligators, which I love. I think that's
they
awesome.
Always, every special that they had on Bond, where they would, that was one of the stunts they would always go over because there was like. When the guy originally ran it, like, one of the alligators snapped at his leg but barely missed or something, they always show that, like, outtake.
Here it comes.
I like that ape ingenuity right there where they, like, put the net on him and then all four of them jump off the other side. I think that's
cool. If one net doesn't work, try 9 more times.
Exactly.
There's the line.
Beautiful. I just took a bath.
What's amazing about Rise of the Planet of the Apes is that they knew how to use that line.
Yes, they were terrible in Tim Burton's.
We don't need to talk about the line used in Tim Burton's, but in Rise, when Draco Malfoy is like, "Get your paws off me," it could seem like a cheesy like way to do it, but then Caesar immediately says no, and that like that settles you down from like recap. Like, what did I just hear that line? And then you're automatically like. Stifled by the fact that, oh, the ape just talked. I forgot that they would do that eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, if I remember correctly, in the Burton version, didn't they say, get your paws off me, damn dirty human?
Yes.
Didn't they switch
really
around?
Okay.
Okay.
Obvious.
Then they looked at the camera, pointed, and winked.
Yeah.
that's what happened.
Pretty much. The glorious thing of Rise of the Planet of the Apes is like you forgot everything these movies were. Watching that one, it was so compelling that, I mean, when Caesar spoke and said no, it was like, whoa! And at the end when he said Caesar is home, you're like, holy crap! And you're like, oh wait, yeah, these are movies where apes talk.
Yeah.
And they actually look like apes, too. I mean, yeah. We talked before about how these look like mutated humans or whatever. They actually were much more animalistic. And, yeah, so again, I credit Andy Serkis with that.
For sure, yeah. And yeah, you're just not expecting this, like, oh yeah, they're talking. They're standing and everything, too.
Yeah.
The madhouse thing, I like that.
But, you know, I think, you know, I don't have a problem with, like, stuff with Rise of the Planet Apes stuff, because there's such a distance between this movie and Rise that, you know, so much has changed in filmmaking culture and so much, you know, styles, pacing, effects and stuff that you can make a respectable reboot, remake, and have them coexist without huge comparisons all the time.
I agree.
You can see this movie and see where, okay, I could see where you could do modern stuff, but if you remake something that's like maybe even 20 years old, it's still almost too soon. And you're picking properties that already have stuff that's locked down and not...
So it's a Mark Webb.
Yeah.
You know, I mean where do you draw the line with the reboot, though, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm so happy about Shane Black with the new Predator saying, no, this is not a reboot. I'm not restarting this universe. I want to play in it some more. And because it feels like every time they get in a corner, they just reboot. And I always like seeing how they work their way out of sequels.
Like, I don't even know how you'd reboot Predator. Like, you can't get rid of that design. Like, I don't know what the idea would be at that point.
Straight up remake a Predator 2.
Do it the way they want to do it. Do it in New York.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Predator, the way the Predator series is, like, a reboot's worthless because all of them kind of stand on their own.
Yeah, they're all, yeah, exactly. So none of them connect to each other beyond...
Right.
There's some drop lines in 2 that relate to 1. But aside from that, Predator 2, you could see it as your first Predator movie and have no problem jumping in or anything. Same with Predators. They're all kind of progress the story of the Predator, but they're all standalone and, you know, kind of reboots in their own right.
What if they just went like the Texas Chainsaw 3D route and did Predator 3D, so it's like technically a second sequel to the first movie in 3D, and it's just very confusing.
There you go. Well, Texas Chainsaw, they just remade the first movie a bunch.
With Texas Chainsaw 3D, where it's technically a sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
This is the 7th film in the franchise, but follows the first film, so it's kind of the second.
You know how, like, crazy my mind went when they, like, on the... Because it's just somebody messed up on the next weekend when they're like, we've greenlit Texas Chainsaw 4 because they couldn't wrap their minds around what happened with putting 3D at the end of the title for Texas Chainsaw 3D.
Yes!
That just, like, my eyes spun as if it was, like, a slot machine, and, like, question marks came up when they stopped.
Well, they
like,
they greenlit that back in 1994. We know this already.
Oh, my God. I'm glad he's talking now. This is where I calm down with this movie. Which fortunately has another hour.
I don't mind him not being able to talk because we're learning more about the apes.
No, it's not a matter of it's not a matter of minding or finding flaw in the movie. It's just my natural emotions that come from the situation that Taylor's in become far too relatable, where I'm like, I'm really frustrated just like he is. It makes me just irritated. Not that it diminishes the quality of said movie or my thoughts on said movie. It's just like that's how I'm coming at it from an emotional level at that point. So now I'm just dealing with Taylor watching stubborn people, stubborn apes, or mainly stubborn Dr. Zaius, not listen. While Taylor's man boob hangs out and he has to conceal his modesty again.
Who is this Moses?
Heston man ass.
More Heston butt, yeah.
That look he gives, dude, is like, alright. What's the overall goal of this tribunal? Like, what will be the end game of this?
All three of them look like Paul Williams.
I mean, the goal is to get Taylor to have a lobotomy, probably.
I guess so.
Or to cut him up to find out why he can talk and the others cannot. Yeah.
So they can, for the orangutans, they could stop him. right there.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's an affront to their religion. I mean, they have that whole monologue where, you know, beware man, the beast, he will bring you down, he will, you know, he will sow his evil and iniquity within you, yada, 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 or whatever.
Yeah, that's where it works as a 70s sci-fi movie that has just big ideas being put into a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, in space, Brant is in cryo sleep, coming after Taylor.
Yeah. Something I like about the box set that I have for Planet of the Apes series is that it has a whole timeline of everything within the box. It details. So
it's James Whitmore as the president there. Interesting.
Yep. Yeah. But yeah, the box set details like everything based on the movies of a timeline that has helpful years and when everything.
Where do they place Conquest following Escape? Because there's like a fan debacle over how many years that comes after. Because there's either 27 years after it or 12.
I have to go pick it up from the other room to tell you. I'll let you know later, I guess, but I don't know offhand.
So no, Conquest for me, that one really took to me because I think at my age, like one of the darkest, you know, normal movies that wasn't like horror or something I had seen was like Empire Strikes Back, and then I go to Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and it's like, holy crap. Like I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and with the ending was kind of surprising to me because I kind of was on Caesar's side because the humans are pretty bad people in that movie, the way they treat apes. So I kind of figured, I thought maybe Caesar would fail because his parents failed at the end of the third one, and every movie ended with failure. Mm-hmm. And to see him actually, you know, succeed and stuff, that was a shock. And to see the humans, like, you know, lose was even bigger. And just how the scenery, the way it's shot with all the fire in the background and this, like, hollow, empty, lifeless kind of city, the hands of the apes was just something else. Like I just can't place how like that took me, and I really like that movie because of the trip it took me on. Now everything's got to be dark and gritty and stuff like that, but at the time, I mean, it fit the 70s vibe, but like this didn't take that angle.
The thing that kind of bothered me about that movie, though, maybe it's just because I haven't seen it in a long time, if I watched it again it would kind of, you know, wouldn't be a problem, was how the apes were used as, you know, basically slave labor.
Yeah.
And how that all came about. I was just kind of like, hubba wah? Like, where did that come from, you know?
They got something wiped out cats and dogs.
The previous owners of slave labor.
Yeah. And people took apes in as pets, but then they learned that apes learned really fast and could do household chores and stuff, and it sort of led to this sort of slavery type thing where they were, you know, taking the place of janitors and things like that, and that's where, you know, things started. Apes didn't know any better, but then Caesar, who was in the circus and was living this other life raised by Ricardo Montalban, got, you know, for his first trip into the city and witnessed all this and started seeing this turnaround. And Ricardo Montalban ends up sacrificing himself at the hands of the humans because of, you know, them wanting to get to Caesar so bad. And that's when he kind of loses his faith in all the humanity and begins teaching all the apes.
And, you know, you think of, you look at the idea of apes being used as servants, and that's almost something that you can see crazy rich people doing in a plausible reality. We're like,
I guess when I saw it as a kid, it just didn't jive.
And that one's got a crazy sense of style too that I like. That,
yeah, I do like the styles of 1991.
Yeah, well, it's kind of 1990. That's true. It's kind of very. I think each of these apes movies had like sort of their own influence on the future of films, like stylistically, have been taken. Because there's stuff with like Battle for the Planet of the Apes. I feel like there's a lot of like Mad Max seeds in the style of the mutants in that movie.
I think Escape's the only one that's, you know, taking away from what the style of the times were.
It was just 70s. I mean, that's about all. They had there. That's the only one lacking in the unique style, but it's one of the better movies.
I'm looking at the ratings for each one, Rotten Tomato wise, and Planet of the Apes.
Battle has a horrible one. I think there's only two fresh ones. It's Escape in the first one.
It's Escape and Planet. Yeah, Planet has like 89, yeah. Beneath has 41, Escape has 78. People liked Escape, apparently, and Conquest has 44, and then Battle has 38.
Like I said forever, the Escape was the popular one.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, some of those, you know, people who reviewed them back then may not be as harsh on them now.
Sure, yeah. Because
Beneath has gained in popularity in it, since the time it's been out. And I really think Battle needs to look back over to understand the situation with which it was made, and that it still has a lot of its own unique themes with the Planet of the Apes, and I think it's still somewhat of a satisfying conclusion, even if it is one of the weaker films. I don't think it's as bad as that Rotten Tomato critic rating. The fan, you know, audience ratings on old movies, I don't take too seriously on something like Rotten Tomatoes, because you get some 8-year-old, 12-year-old that can't understand how to watch a, you know, vintage film.
This is freaky stuff too. This just seeing him, you know, have a giant lobotomized section of his head.
And it looks good. It doesn't look like some huge hunk of plaster put on his head to make it look like that.
Oh, bigger than this.
Yeah.
Yep. First net success.
Bonus. Beat these guys back into submission, by the way.
I agree with you on the look of Conquest, though. It has that, like, 70s futurist look where
the
entire
Logan's
future
Run
looks like an office complex. And
yeah. But it's like, lifeless. Cool, and it's cool looking, but it's, like, really hollow. And, like, the police state kind of look of it. And and I think, like, something like The Hunger Games really takes from that, too. Like, modern day.
Is this the last we see of Landon, by the way?
I think so.
I think that's the last time we see him, right?
Yeah, we just see him for that effect. Like, because he's been looking for him this whole time.
Yeah.
And then we find him, and it's like, all your friends are gone.
Good point about The Hunger Games, by the way, in terms of kind of taking futurist ideas for fashion sense. And that's something I think those movies do well.
Oh, yeah, I love the
I'm a fan of those movies in general, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, I really like them, too. And one thing that, you know, made me like them even more was where they were borrowing their sense of style for science fiction from.
Yeah.
Which was super cool. Because something like The Apple, too. Jim, you like that movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
That kind of takes that to another level, that sort of state that Conquest has.
That's something, I mean, not to go too far into Hunger Games, but that is something I like in general about that series. It has a lot of 70s sci-fi in it. Like, it has big ideas wrapped around a main concept with this kind of futurist look at society that is fitting of movies of the 70s. It's also, you know, dark and violent. Yes.
And it's really something we need right now to take from something like that, because a lot of the sci-fi in big budget things tends to just blend together and look the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Roddy McDowall, I mean, this was like, he was stuck with this. This was like what he's most known for. There's Fright Night, but.
I mean, his real claim to fame was as a child actor in National Velvet and the Flicka series and stuff. But yeah, as an adult, this is definitely what he's best known for.
Yeah. And he, when I didn't see any of the sequels till they aired on Sci-Fi Channel, and he hosted them.
Yeah.
And it was like
embodying his Fright Night character.
Yes, yeah, very much so. He came full circle. I think he died shortly after those.
Yeah, I like the see no evil, hear no evil nonsense that these guys are doing.
Yes. It's a good image.
It is. It's obvious.
It's good. On the nose, yeah. Ryan McDowell, like, I loved how they, you know, would show them with his tidbits and stuff like that. You don't get a lot of that with movies on television or anything anymore, unless you're watching Turner Classic Movies. And also on the sets, the Blu-ray, at least the Blu-rays, they have Conquest in an unrated cut.
Yes, that form. Battle.
And Battle is extended.
Extended version, yeah.
Wow.
I think Battle, they threw some TV scenes in and re-edited things to make a little more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the TV series, I think, I remember watching that quite a bit when I was a kid. I think it was on if I'm not mistaken, it was on either the same day or maybe even the same channel as the $6 Million Man Bionic Woman pairing.
Okay.
It might have been the same night of the week, if I remember correctly. This is a long time ago. I was very, very small. But then I remember seeing in the 80s, they had taken like several of those episodes from the TV shows and cut them into like made-for-TV movie-length movies with like, you know, Return to the Refuge of the Planet of the Apes, or, you know what I mean? Just like every conceivable permutation of Planet of the Apes possible to make them into like hour-and-a-half-long TV movies.
Well, it's like... Because sometimes, like, with the sci-fi, with the franchise opportunities, they went to TV. Like, Logan's Run got a television series. It didn't get a sequel, but it got a television series, right?
Right. Yeah.
It was about a bunch of teenagers.
Yeah. No, it starred Gregory Harrison, ended up being on Trapper John MD and a bunch of other TV in the 70s. Do you know why you're here in the principal's office, Taylor?
Do you know what you did? I like that Zayas has, like, kind of nighttime clothing.
It's casual orangutan.
Like, this is his equivalent of a smoking jacket. He's, like, Hefnering out right now.
No, there's his orange coat hanging up behind Taylor.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a hot date with an eye in about a half hour, so I gotta wrap this up. I like how he's smoking, too. That's awesome.
I want to see the process of, like, apes making cigarettes.
Yeah.
It's kind of... One thing I like in, you know, Battle is the full circle of the Lawgiver, who we see here in statue form all over the place, and in the next one, and then in the final one, he's narrating.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, if you like the franchise a whole lot, then Boom has put out a whole bunch of really good comics in the Planet of the Apes canon as well. Some really good stuff. The Planet of the Apes, the adjectiveless Planet of the Apes comic for a long time was almost like Game of Thrones with apes. It's a really good Gabriel Hardman art. And then the author is escaping me at the moment. I'll have to look it up. But they did really well. They did write with the franchise for sure in a lot of their comic adaptations.
I've heard that. I never read the comics, but I'm aware that they, you know, are quite popular and like well regarded.
Carlos Gagno. There we go. That's the name of the artist. It's amazing because not only does he draw humans really well, but also the apes, you know, very expressively and very well. So, but yeah, if you're a fan of the franchise, I definitely seek out the comics from Boom.
See, this is why listeners love these commentaries. Look at how much info we're packing in. We have this comic discussion coming in.
What other opportunity do I really have to showcase all this useless information?
Exactly.
That I packed away in my head. Yeah, I'm just blessed that I have some outlet for it, or I'd probably explode.
So. I'm just honored to share my passion for this with you guys and have great conversations with people who also, you know a lot about this stuff and bounce back off one another.
I mean, it's fun to do when we just have to be recording it, basically. That's the difference.
Yeah.
Wasn't the original plan for the sequel to kind of reverse the fish out of water, where Taylor has, like, met with other humans and started his own colony, and an ape gets, you know, picked up in there, and then it ends up in a big fight between the humans and the apes, a big war, but Heston wasn't down for doing much in the sequel, so they kind of scrapped the idea.
That seems like certainly a possibility that they could have done. I am aware that Heston wasn't really like, I need to play Taylor again. Ah.
He said his one condition on coming back was a minimal shooting and kill me dead. Like, I no way I'm coming back.
Oh, he pulled a Ripley, huh?
Yeah, and so...
he gets an and in the credits, too. He's at the very end, and Charlton Heston is Taylor, if I remember correctly.
And he made, and not even the bomb could end the series, but he never came back. Because Escape is shortly after his rocket had taken off when they landed in the 70s, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We could talk about that a bit, too, Beneath's ending, which is just one of the...
It's one of the craziest endings to a science fiction G-rated movie you'll ever see.
let alone one that you wouldn't think would, you know, allow a series to keep going, yet it did.
It did, yeah. It was the most finite ending that three films followed it.
Yeah.
Normally, Nuclear Annihilation would be a damper on your franchise, but no, not this time.
Yeah,
there's like a craziest, a weird, it just, oh, it's so, it's glorious.
Where that music will haunt me till I die. That music, we show our true faces to the almighty bomb. No, I mean, as a kid who had to go to Catholic school and go to church every day before class, it resonated with me even to this day.
Well, I rewound it. I couldn't believe what I just saw. I wanted to make sure that that was what happened.
Like, what does Taylor say? What's his last line, do you know? Because I know there's some narration after that, which
it's
is also...
some over-dramatic, like, Charlton Heston totally wanted to do this.
Yeah, basically. It is. But it sticks with you just in terms of, like, him pressing that button then. And then, like, the narration at that point, it's like, blah, blah, and a green, insignificant planet is now dead. Like, it's just, like, it's like, wow.
There's like, the narration, like, and he's sitting there holding, like, a gashing gunshot wound on his chest, crawling over, and just hits the, like, it's not how it's supposed to end. Like,
it looks like he falls down dead on the button, if I remember correctly. Like you said, it's been a little while.
It's his intent to get it, but yeah, he's dying as he gets over there, because Franciscus tries to get over, and he gets, like I said, he gets shot in the head with a blood splatter coming out the back, rated G.
Rated G, everybody.
It's like
Cornelius or Caesar kills a guy at the end of Conquest, and no, you better change that to at least get a PG.
It takes the old to live and die in LA approach, just murdering your lead character.
Man, there's, you know, they introduce us to these mutants who, seconds before this reveal, peel their faces off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're worshiping the nuke. It's just so much craziness. Like, lots of great aesthetics, sets, costuming, just ideas going around.
I think it was season 9 when Mystery Science Theater came back to the Sci-Fi Channel.
And they had
a whole series of interstitials making fun of the Planet of the Apes movies, where Pearl Forrester was the lawgiver, and they had Professor Bobo, and they had to keep from putting on diapers and riding unicycles because that's how they felt free. And
those were the main characters for a couple seasons, because they had the daughter as the main villain, and all her cohorts were Planet of the Apes characters.
I like this. This kind of day for night shooting that they're doing right now, because it's supposed to be nighttime, and they just kind of like, we'll dim it and we'll make it seem like it's night.
Now, speaking of nighttime, the first like three quarters of Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes is all night.
Oh yeah,
it's so dull and boring.
Yeah,
like it's just night, like it's incredible. I was surprised.
It's like he has like Big Fish after, but yeah, Planet of the Apes is like. It was such a weird, like, change-up for me as a person that's grown up watching Tim Burton movies.
It's where it just started, you know, there's the Tim Burton of the late 80s and 90s, and then it's Tim Burton from before Sleepy Hollow and after Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, it is.
I'll give him Big Fish, but
yes.
And Sweeney Todd as well. I mean, it's just they feel like movies that someone aping Tim Burton would do, and it just happens to be him.
Oh, Aaron.
I feel like, look, with Tim Burton, there are some ideas I think he really falls in love with, and there are just some ideas he thinks sound fun. And I think the Planet of the Apes falls into the latter of that category. He obviously had a real affection for like Vincent Price and that kind of thing. You see that in Scissorhands and things like that. But
I think with
Planet of the Apes and you know, Dark Shadows and some of his other times where he stepped in to try to, you know, put his stamp or imprimatur on franchises, he's kind of missed the mark.
Planet of the Apes, I could see Planet of the Apes as something where he was given that opportunity. And because of his association with that movie and maybe kind of the Rod Serling aspect, it's like, yeah, all right, I could do my spin on this, but yeah, not something he's entirely passionate about compared to other movies in his canon up to that point.
Well, I just think the novelty of his take on things has just worn off. Because it's like, what, Tim Burton's blah. Tim Burton's this, and it's not, like, original stuff. It's just adapted things, which he's, you know, kind of always had that, but there's, you know, far less Edward Scissorhands in Mars Attacks now. It's just...
I don't know if it's worn off. It's just it doesn't feel as creative or fresh.
Like, oh, yeah, yeah. That's what I say, the novelty of, like, ooh, Tim Burton's doing this?
I mean, I think we're attacking things at the same point, just from different angles. I mean, I feel like if I saw a Tim Burton movie that his aesthetic isn't something that I'm tired of. It's just I don't think I've seen it in the freshest of ways in a long time.
Right. I still haven't seen Alice in Wonderland because I just didn't care.
You don't need to.
I haven't either. Actually,
don't worry about that.
I just didn't care. I like Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd's solid.
It was solid, but I mean. Yeah, just Alice in Wonderland, I just didn't care. It took me forever to see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory because I didn't care.
Yeah, that's another one.
That was on cable, I think.
I just don't care. Now, all this said, I mean, Big Eyes, this movie coming up this year, is supposed to be really good. Like, yeah. It's getting a lot of good buzz, a lot of, like, Oscar buzz. So.
Yeah,
it's about the
due King
paintings and stuff, right?
Yeah, yes. Anyway, back to Planet of the Apes when these damn scarecrows.
Boy, this is so ironic seeing Linda Harrison here in light of all of her later work.
What's her career consist of after these Apes movies?
Nothing. Yeah. Just being sarcastic.
She was in Dunstan Checks In, classic Ape movie. And the Cocoons.
Can we talk about some of the other Apes directors a bit?
Sure.
Like, the fourth and fifth one are J. Lee Thompson, and he did Guns of Navarone and Cape Fear, the original Cape Fear.
The original Cape Fear, yeah.
Yeah, he did Death Wish 4.
If people have only seen Cape Fear of De Niro and Nick Nolte, watch the original Cape Fear, because that movie's scary.
Yeah, Robert Mitchum is awesome.
Yeah. That is a good movie.
Make it a double feature with Out of the Past. And
you got the eyebrows and Peckham and Mitchum's voice. I mean, Jesus, that's a movie.
He also
I don't know if he's more threatening in that or in Night of the Hunter.
Night of the Hunter. He's pretty terrifying in Night of the Hunter.
He also did a... J. Lee Thompson did a personal favorite of mine, Happy Birthday to Me.
Yeah.
Which has a crazy ending. But yeah, he's a long time, a lot of stuff from him.
Is he alive? Nope, not anymore. Died in 2002. Mm-hmm. What else? Who else we got? Don Taylor, who did Escape. Planet of the Apes.
Did Escape. He was, I think, mainly a TV director.
Yeah,
same
it's
with
kind of there. It's kind of there in his essay. Oh, he did Damien the Omen, too. That's right, after this.
He was an actor, also.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They got him because of... they wanted him to inject comedy into it. Had
Ted
Final
Post
Countdown.
Pretty much a TV director as well. He did Twilight Zone, all kind of The Rifleman, a lot of 60s TV.
Him and Eastwood liked him as a director, but I think during Magnum Force they had a falling out.
He did direct Good Guys Wear Black, one of the early Chuck Norris, if not the first early Chuck Norris movies. So.
What's Rupert Wyatt up to now that he's not doing Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
Moving on to the next franchise.
They call it The Gambler.
You think Rupert Wyatt would have had like the pick of the litter after that, right after Rise of Success?
I'm
curious. He did the pilot of Turn.
He did the pilot of Turn. I did notice that too when I saw that first episode. It's like, oh yeah. And like Chuck Heston's like, finally a shave. Ah. And the reaction to it where he look uglier. Or less intelligent, right?
Must just stay away from the Forbidden Zone.
Right now, at this time, Dr. Milo is like, aha! Time travel, I've discovered it. I cannot wait to tell Cornelius and Zero when they get back.
curious how Rupert Wyatt got Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Like, he came from nothing.
Was there anybody else attached to that before? I'm sure there was.
I'm sure there was. I just, you know. I like how this movie doesn't really have a giant action scene at the end, by the way. Like, it has some shooting in it, but it's like, it's not focused on, as opposed to the Tim Burton remake, it's not focused on a, you know, a battle of the Planet of the Apes. Like, there's people, you know, there's a standoff that occurs and, you know, some shots fired, but it's not about, like, Chuck Heston getting a group of people together to, like, fight this horrible band of apes or whatnot. They basically just have a conversation.
It's a dramatic standoff, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need it. It's just not...
No, yeah, the movie's smarter than that. Like, the movie...
There's no situation where he's going to win against all the apes. It's just...
Although, if he did shoot Dr. Zaius in the head, I'd probably, like, cheer or something. I don't see anything about other directors for...
Dr. Zaius does end up dying, so...
Well, yeah, so...
I'd say my most annoying ape is General Aldo from Battle. My gosh.
Oh, yeah, Claude Akins.
Yeah, he's... Annoys me.
He carried over into the TV series, actually.
As the character, or just the... I know a lot of the actors played different people. And no, Austin Stoker is in that movie, too, as a human. From Assault on Precinct 13, and I think he did a voice on the cartoon as well.
I forgot Rise lost best visual effects to Hugo, which... I'll allow, because Hugo is my favorite movie of that year, but still.
Oh, to keep with today's announcement of the Blu-ray set of the 1960s Batman, which is awesome, King Tut was in Beneath Planet of the Apes.
Well, he was Victor Bono. He was one of the main mutants. But, I mean, in this scene right here, you've got Roddy McDowell, who played the bookworm in the original Batman TV series. And Dr. Zaius was also, he was, oh crap. Now I'm going to have to look it up.
Oh my God.
He was also in the Batman 66 series as a villain. I just saw him about a couple months ago.
Find it. Batman, found it. Roddy McDowell. He's bookworm.
Roddy McDowell was a bookworm, but Maurice.
You're looking at Maurice.
Maurice Evans was one as well. Yeah, I think the Pied Piper or the Trickster or something like that.
Oh my God. That's going to bug me. I've got to really look into it.
It's going to bug me, too.
You stay out here, son. Still, you know, under the assumption that we're on a different planet, I do like seeing the beaches. You know, because those high cliffs right there kind of... Just the way this movie's constructed, I mean, it just works.
I like the look of the area they got here with the planks and
the puzzler.
The puzzler. I knew it was puzzler. Some sort of knockoff of the Riddler.
Yeah, we can't get the Riddler this week. Was it during Gorshin's hiatus?
I'm sure.
Probably.
Season 2.
He appeared on Man from U.N.C.L.E. in the same year, so. Yeah, I remember Roddy McDowell baking the dynamic duo in a giant cookbook.
How come those villains weren't in the Nolan verse? That hat trick.
See, now he'd be like,
I was hoping the minstrel would show up.
Chef.
Minstrel, get Calendar Man in there too. Why not?
The minstrel and the archer who looked.
First was Louis the Lilac.
Oh.
Or Milton Berle was Louis
Milton
the Lilac. Or Minerva.
I like to think that the Batman producers like, we got Berle! And they proceeded to create some kind of crazy character for him.
Yeah. And then I also remember the one where they went after Phineas Fogg, and they didn't go to London, they went to Londinium, if I remember correctly. Because I guess Gotham City, you know, is New York, and I guess Londinium would be London.
These reveals, and this, by the way, we're talking about Planet of the Apes. These reveals that Dr. Zaius has been, you know, known about all this stuff and has bones collected and has, like, it just makes me hate Zaius more.
Yeah.
But I do like these kind of twists. I like thinking of this as a movie that you're seeing for the first time and, you know, not knowing the Earth twist. Like, it is neat to see, like, where is this going? Like, I'm sure the audience is like, their minds are stirring right now about like, what's happening? Like, where is this movie going at this point? Where we're out of Ape Town and we're getting into the Forbidden Zone, which is called the Forbidden Zone, so it makes that automatically intriguing. It's like, what's the end game in this movie? Like, what's going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. So I like Mad Men a couple seasons ago when Don Draper went and saw this in the theater.
With his son,
and I think he had the perfect reaction with his look on his face when the twist happened at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decided to sit and watch the movie again in the theater. I thought it was great.
I love the way Mad Men handles that kind of pop culture stuff. That's just always fascinating to me.
It's not in your face. It's It's just natural. And like, whereas Masters of Sex is a similar show, but I think they try to make a point to showcase some of that stuff rather than just naturally weave it in.
I'm excited for season two just because I think it will be able to hammer out some of the kinks of things that didn't work as well in that show, which is, I think, a very good show. I really like
it. Oh, no, it is good.
Yeah. But, I mean, I am excited because, you know, second season of these dramas tend to work better with what they know they can do well.
So. Yeah, because they filmed that whole first season without any kind of public reaction or critical analysis.
Yeah.
It's something I've been meaning to watch. I do like Michael Sheen quite a bit.
Michael Sheen, Lizzie Kaplan's great in the show.
Yeah,
I mean,
she's usually really good, too.
What's his name?
D'Agostino really impressed me. I'd seen him in things before where I was like, "Eh," but he was actually pretty good in that.
Beau Bridges and Allison Janney, they're I mean,
you're a huge Beau Bridges fan too, right, Aaron?
You know, in that show, I liked him quite a bit. Yeah. I was surprised how much I liked Beau Bridges in that show. I don't have anything against him. It's just like I don't care generally.
You,
when I
you
see
don't
him.
See what the big deal is.
Like, where's Jeff?
John Belushi is to Jim Belushi as Jeff Bridges is to Beau Bridges.
There you go.
And we all RIP Miss Lloyd.
What's Zira playing with? What's Nova playing with?
The baby doll.
Is it just a doll?
A creepy baby doll.
I thought it was creepy like a doll. Skull for a second. I was like, what's happening back there?
You think this would be the tip off, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, but there are humans on this planet, so I mean, it's
conceivable they had ceramic technology and knew how to make plastics and
it's obvious. It's just layering in ideas like what's going on.
But I mean, this whole movie, for someone who saw it, you know, with unspoiled or unknowing the of what's going to happen, you still just they're not on Earth. It's called Planet of the Apes. So you're watching a movie about a guy landing on a planet full of apes.
Yeah, it just that's such a. You get all these movies that have these giant twists, like Empire and this and whatever else that I can't think of right offhand at this very moment. Soylent Green, and you wonder like how those reactions play. Sometimes it's like what it is to have that for the first time and not have, you know, years of pop culture jokes and whatnot giving you hints, even if you didn't know the exact thing, and just have this kind of first reveal in an era where you don't have these kind of twists happen all the time.
Did you know who Kaiser Soze was?
I mean, I hadn't seen Usual Suspects before I saw, like, a ton of things that spoofed the him dropping the coffee cup in slow motion, but I didn't know who Kaiser Soze was necessarily. So, like, the twist was maintained for me, but the kind of reveal of it was certainly something I was familiar with, I guess.
I think it's on the repeat viewings, like this, you watch and you go, how did I not think this?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's there, the clues are given to you, but it doesn't count when you're watching it the second time and you know it's coming. It's when you know,
I remember being a young enough kid that I had to have my dad explain it to me. You know, I was like, well, why is the Statue of Liberty there? And he's like, because it was Earth the whole time. And then my mind was blown. You know what I mean? Because I was very small when I first saw this.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You better be careful. These guys are masters of guerrilla warfare.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I tried to keep the 8 puns to a minimum, but I couldn't let that one go.
We all got one in, it seems.
So. I'm surprised no one's messed with it. Speaking of those, I was thinking today, I was like, I'm surprised no one's ever messed with the logo from Escape from the Planet of the Apes and focused on the ape portion of the word escape. Seems like a ripe opportunity.
Yeah.
Ape of the Planet of the Apes. Or just Cape of the Planet of the Apes. You just draw a bunch of capes on all the apes.
Yes.
That'd be sweet.
And speaking of, it's a shame we couldn't have Abraham Moa here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. He's monkeying around at work still. Even like the Vader twist, like I saw that one because I watched those movies back to back to back in a session that I refer to as the greatest time of my life for the first time. And,
it was last year,
and it like the reaction I had was like, well, that's a neat development. Like, that's literally how I, like, thought of seeing Vader as, like, the twist. It's like, well, that's neat. Like, that was, like, my four-year-old, like, understanding of what just has, like, huh.
That was my first ever time of being spoiled ahead of time from a movie, because I think it was maybe 1 or 2 weeks before the movie was released, I found the Marvel Super Special comic book adaptation on the racks of my local 7-Eleven while I was, you know, in the middle of playing Donkey Kong or Popeye or whatever. And it had the entire movie, like, adapted into a comic. And I read the comic ahead of time. That was the first time I ever really got spoiled to a major story before going to the movie.
Do you have that still?
That comic? Yeah, I think I have it around here somewhere.
Sounds amazing.
Well, I think I had the same reaction as you did, Aaron, when I first saw that, too, because I was at such a young age, it wasn't like, whoa! It was just like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, and you know, I can't exactly remember how it felt.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was, because I was such a young age when I saw it, it just became something I always knew. And
I mean, this is like, because I literally, when I first saw Star Wars, I watched all of them back to back, like in one sitting. It was like I was in Vegas. I know I was in Vegas at my quote unquote godmother's house watching these movies. And it was like, this is just awesome. And it's like, oh, that was a thing. And then I remember just being really intrigued by speeder bikes. And like, that was the end of the day for me. It's like, oh, this is the coolest thing ever now. Like, I thought these other things I saw were pretty good, but speeder bikes, this is
awesome. Speeder bikes were awesome.
It sounds like a really good day.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Went to Medieval Times for the first time at Excalibur.
Oh,
wow.
It was a good weekend for Star Wars. And
you're like, lightsaber battles to sword battles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, I literally remember sitting on the sidewalk of the 7-Eleven drinking a Slurpee next to my bike reading that comic. And then trying to convince my friends that, oh, no, this is the movie that's coming out. This is the story of the movie. And they just thought it was another Marvel Star Wars comic.
Oh, wow. I remember reading Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
Yes, I remember reading that too, and thinking for a long time that was going to be the sequel.
Yeah.
When I was a kid.
And though we know that one that went right out of continuity the minute Empire came out.
Yep.
Kim Hunter's career didn't really go anywhere after Escape from the Planet of the Apes. She was in some stuff, but she
wanted Escape to be her last one.
I mean, but even in general.
Yeah.
And she died of a heart attack too in 2000. She was 79. But, like, I mean, she's coming up, like, not coming off, but, like, early, I mean, her early breakout role was Streetcar Named Desire, right? So, I mean.
Right.
Yeah. But, like, these
eight. Nothing, too. I mean, they had, this is really high caliber class of cast for this period, too. Hmm. Especially for, you know, for science fiction, which at that point really wasn't thought of as, you know, having any of the prestige it does now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was
this film in, like, 2001 that brought it back.
Mm-hmm.
And then it started going down a little, and then Star Wars brought it back.
Yep.
Right.
Well, just that blockbuster era of like, let's do things. Let's get crazy with it, guys. Like Close Encounters. Actually, is Close Encounters a hit? Was that a hit movie?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big hit.
Yeah.
They released
it
multiple times.
It wasn't as big as Star Wars, but it was big. Yeah.
Because it came after Jaws, right? Or no, it came after. Did it come after Jaws?
It was
his follow up to Jaws.
When was 41? When was 1941?
Right, it was released in several editions. There was a special edition with like added footage that came out. There was
they had an alternate. They reshot.
You're right. I'm
retarded. Yeah,
it's gonna be like $303 million worldwide. So that's a good hit.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think Close Encounters has been theatrically released like three or four times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the interesting thing about that, I mean, going back to something you were talking about earlier about how we know so much about movies now when they come out. When that movie came out, we knew almost nothing about it.
Yeah. That's
I mean, the entire ad campaign was just that bright light at the end of the road.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, you know,
I was saying that that's something
contrast.
Like somebody like J.J. Abrams like strives to recreate but gets harshly criticized for wanting to do something like that. In this day and age of entitlement and wanting, demanding all we, you know everything about the movie before we go in.
I mean, there's a line there too, though, because I think something like Super 8, it works for that movie because that you just don't like he just shot that and you're like, oh, this movie happened, all right, and then there's a trailer like that's
if you're doing such and such part 5. I mean,
yeah, when you're doing Star Trek Into Darkness, Into the Fire, I mean, it's it just it has a different feel where you're like, even me as not a huge Star Trek fan, I'm thinking, I mean, it's one thing to not want to share too much, but at the same time, it was like, what's really the cause here of not telling you Khan's in it? Like, what's like,
yeah, what? It would have sold more tickets too.
Exactly. Yeah, I do. I really think that. Like,
it wouldn't have made for a better movie. It just, I mean, it probably would have been a better public, you know, bigger.
Well, even the reaction to it could have been better. Just because, well, I mean, it was good though, right? It has like a what, like an 89 or something on Rotten Tomatoes. Like,
yeah.
But then the backlash came at it too. Like, it's just, yeah, it's a tricky line to walk where you're in this modern age where you're trying to do something that evokes a time period of old. And
it's also up to the person at hand. Like, I pick and choose what trailers I watch for whatever. I pick and choose what articles I watch and whatever. I almost never watch the early release clips of every movies. Because I don't want to, I want to see it in context of what I'm watching.
Oh yeah, I never see clips anymore. I see trailers and teasers and whatnot, and
But I mean, back then, as big as Jaws was, you know, it was Spielberg's follow-up to Jaws. I mean, if that had happened today, after you know somebody making as huge a movie as Jaws was back in the day, you know, we would be all over every little bit of information that movie would be out. And when Close Encounters came out, there was almost. I remember the trailer for it. It was like, you know, basically, you know, driving down a road toward that light, and they gave the definitions of what Close Encounters of the First and Second and then Third Kind were.
Yeah.
And that was the trailer. You know? Yeah,
it's a cool trailer.
You know, no dry fits, no giant lights in the sky, no Truffaut, none of that. And I mean, like you say, you know, they tried to bring that stuff back, but it's just almost impossible.
It works in like Cloverfield. It worked. You know, I think for an original movie, it'll work. But when you're doing a franchise reboot, remake. I think everybody's like, well, there's no secrets with this anymore. We know
even like teasers for things work too, though. Like like Nolan's Batman teasers and whatnot, and even like Transformers, that first teaser where they're just on Mars. Like, they're effective. Mm-hmm. Like, they do their job.
Right.
Fun thing, J. Lee Thompson, who directed the last two Apes films in this, you know, canon series, he was considered for Planet of the Apes, as was Blake Edwards.
For the first one, or for the first one.
Whoa.
Breakfast at Tiffany's and Pink Panther's Blake Edwards.
Yeah. SOB's Blake Edwards.
We talked all over this ending, by the way, about not Planet of the Apes, but I mean, here we go. We're getting to it now. We're getting to the twist here, which even then, it's funny how it's revealed. You don't really get what's going on.
Yeah, you're like,
for a couple minutes here.
Are they going to, like, I thought maybe, like, there was someone going to pick them off or something.
Yeah. Like,
they just told them.
Or they were just right off into the sunset.
Oh, well, I mean, the way it's set up, yeah, for sure, because you have Zayas, like, blowing up the, like, it's like, we'll erase all evidence of any of this ever. Like, we'll just pretend this guy, we'll make it a Simpsons Principal Skinner situation and just pretend none of this ever happened. He's not Lee Tasmarian or whatever the name is. This never happened. We'll wipe it under the rug.
The Great Ape buried all this stuff to test our faith.
Of course, the next movie just disproves all of that. It's like, whatever. We're gone.
Yeah.
As we go deeper into the Forbidden Zone. But, see, now we get this where it's like a bait and switch, really, because you have Zayas going back and doing his thing and whatever. They'll keep doing their thing, and Taylor's riding off into the sunset with Nova, and it's like, all right, but now the movie's still going for an extra 30 seconds, and why? And you get this weird shot of something metal here. I don't know what that is. Like, that looks weird. And now Heston's angry. Like, it's like, what's happening? And like, it's not like a huge music cue, right? I don't think I'm supposed to be hearing music right now. I can't hear anything. I'm muting it, but I don't recall it being like
it's ding! It's not a dramatic. It's a very subdued cue.
Yeah, compared to something like, no, I am your father, and
music I think the credits
slow
roll
motion
with,
over.
I think
it.
The sound of the waves is the credits.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is. That's, like, because this is a dark ending. Like,
yeah.
It's like, there's nothing for Taylor.
And you know, it's funny. This is a great dark ending that you're like, okay. Never top that, but I mean, they really get close to this ending with like the next three movies.
Planet of the Apes is not a series about optimism.
I mean, the impact of them all works.
They do
in different ways. It's outstanding because you'd never think the sequels would be able to reach this. Even like you would think, let's not even try for that. Let's not even try, but they do and they succeed.
like even like Battle is maybe the only one that ends mm-hmm. somewhat nicely.
it does end nicely, but it does include the death of a child.
For sure, yeah.
Pull it all. Yeah. So its darkness is within the middle of the film because the series has to end, but it does end with that stupid statue crying, which is just like okay, yeah. too much. Yeah. Too much.
Which,
and that's the last image you get of the canon, but yeah, so.
But yeah, I mean, this one, yeah, obviously this, and then the world, they up it in the next one with the world blowing up. And then,
he says, damn you blew it up, and then he blows it up in the next
yeah.
one.
Yeah. And then, you know, we get our lead characters that we like a lot dying, you know, shot down, like gunned down,
assassinated, yeah.
They can't escape, and then Conquest, humanity falls apart.
you get that innocent ape baby shot point blank. In the third one.
And even Rise of the Planet of the Apes, like, Rise, it's like, the credits incorporate the fact that humanity's dying because of a virus. Like, these aren't yeah. optimistic movies.
Yeah. Oh, it's a really interesting take for these movies. And these are, like, G-rated movies, and for the most part, considered, like, when I was growing up, oh, these are for kids.
And they're really, yep. Yeah, they were for kids when they came out. I mean, there was a yeah. Saturday morning cartoon for a long time. Yeah. Well, not a few seasons, but and I mean, Mego's first line of toys before they made the superheroes were Planet of the Apes toys.
I haven't seen the cartoon, but is it like Aeon Flux at every end of every episode? Is it like an ape die or something?
No. No, it is. It is the epitome of the Filmation School of Animation, just really bad and like kind of. A lot of repeated loops of animation, a lot of repeated backgrounds, that kind of thing.
Watching two episodes in a row, you'll probably doze off.
Yeah, you'll be done. You'll get the idea, and you'll have your fill.
There's apes named Hannah's, the run of bananas, Planet of the Apes. I don't know.
Dr. Zayas.
No, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm Troy McClure.
We haven't even talked about how amazing Planet of the Apes the musical could be if it actually came to reality, because just Jeff Goldblum introducing Phil Hartman to the idea of this made me intrigued, which has one of the greatest exchanges of all time in The Simpsons anyway, where it's like, have you heard a little thing called Planet of the Apes, the planet or the movie? Like, that's Phil Hartman being amazing. That's so good.
Oh,
that
God,
kills me. Oh my God, that's funny. We've reached the end of this movie, guys. Talking about Planet of the Apes.
I feel we could go another 2 hours.
We'll come back. We'll come
let's
back.
Pop in beneath. Let's go. This right here, buddy.
Yeah, we won't be doing that right now. We will be doing another commentary soon. As I've kind of said in the past, I think we're going to just start doing at least one commentary every month for Out Now. Which will likely generally involve Brandon and myself, it seems, just because we're always available to do these commentaries. With
you guys love us.
Our rotating crew, which includes my co-host, Abe. But no, I know next month, with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles coming out, that is the plan for the next commentary, the original 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film. So we'll get to that when we get to
and
that.
Of course, if the movie was made before 1985 or so, I'll be there too.
Okay. Yeah, we still have one day we have to do that Escape from New York commentary.
Escape from New York.
Hopefully, I'm hoping for my birthday. That
there you go.
Great.
There we go.
We'll see.
I just ordered my Snake Plissken action figure, by the way.
Nice.
I don't know if you guys heard about that. Funko as part of the Reaction line.
I'll just hope
it's better. I have two different versions of Snake, so.
I'll just assume it's a Comic-Con and try to find it.
We still have to finish up the Evil Dead series.
Yeah, we still have to do our Army of Darkness commentary. What other franchises do we need to finish out?
We have about like 20 Bond movies.
Oh, yeah. We have all the other Bond movies. That's our go-to if we need something 1 month. And we're like, what do we do? Well, Thunderball. We haven't... You know, yes. We didn't even do Dr. No. We did what we do. From Russia with Love.
From Russia with Love, we did
Moonraker,
GoldenEye.
Wow. See, I wish I'd been on your Moonraker show because I love that one.
GoldenEye,
Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, we did four. We did two great ones and two that are like regarded as not being very good. That was the idea for those. So
it's a myth with Moonraker.
I like Moonraker the way you like a child who's just like a total C minus D student. You're just like, you really tried. You know, and you want to pat that movie on the back. That's how I feel about Moonraker anyway.
We like Moonraker.
We do like Moonraker. Yeah.
I've seen it way more times than a human should have, though.
Yeah, that's the reason. All right, with all that said, let's wrap this one up here. Jim, where can people find more of your work online?
HHWLOD.com is the podcasting network where you can find all manner of pop culture podcasting goodness, including the the Jack and Chloe Adventure Cast covering 24, Live Another Day, Bungie, Walking Dead TV podcast, Long Box of Doom, Real Heroes, all kinds of stuff. If you're into geeky stuff like movies, TV, comics, television, or video games, check out hhwlod.com. We're bound to have something you'll enjoy.
Jim, when's your next 1980s Retropolis coming?
I had a big cow emergency here on the farm. I'm hoping to get it out by the end of this week.
Awesome.
In 1985.
Brandon?
My work is at Naptown Nerd, naptownnerd.blogspot.com. I also do Blu-ray reviews and some editorial stuff at whysoblue.com. I co-host with Aaron the Jack and Chloe Adventure Cast, along with Maxwell Haddad. And in the fall, Sleepy Hollow, Ichabod Cranecast.
Yep.
On the HHWOD Network.
I could repeat all that, but I'm not going to. I'll just say that I write for my personal blog, thecodeofzeke.com, as well as at WhySoBlue. And you can follow me on Twitter at AaronsPS4. This has been Out Now with Aaron and Abe, which is available on iTunes and at HHWOD, as well as plenty of other places, Podomatic.com, SoundCloud.com. Everywhere you want to find it, and you know, follow our page out at outnow_podcast1. If you're listening to this commentary at this point, you're probably a fan already, so there you go. But yeah, thanks all the listeners for, you know, staying this long, for hearing our thoughts on Planet of the Apes and plenty of other, you know, related topics as well. Always fun to do these commentaries. And Brandon and Jim, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
For sure. And until next time, when we talk about TURTLE power, that's going to do it. So long and goodbye.